Do 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 do.
God, please stop.
I want to secede from whatever union is responsible there. All right, we ready?
Yep.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Podcast, Monday Editor's Roundtable Edition. I am Matt Welch here with my colleagues Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. What is up, y'all?
It's Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday.
Hi, Matt.
God bless America. We have too many news stories today, chasing too few time slots. For instance, I think even as we're sort of getting our phone call together here, Senator Kamala Harris, who is Catherine Mangu Ward's favorite person in the Senate, has already attempted to derail the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. But first, and we might get to some of that a little bit later here and might not also. But first, I want to revisit an issue that we touched on last week, which is Donald Trump versus Jeff Sessions. Over the weekend, the president explicitly condemned his own attorney general for the Justice Department, recently bringing charges against GOP Congressman Duncan Hunter and Chris Collins. Quote, two long-running Obama-era investigations of two very popular Republican congressmen were brought to a well-publicized charge just ahead of the midterms by the Jeff Sessions Justice Department. Two easy wins now in doubt because there is not enough time. Good job, Jeff. So, Nick, I want to start with you. Since last week when we were talking about this, you brought up the always accurate point that attorneys general tend to be lackeys for the president and do the president's dirty work. And you were also arguing in favor that Trump should fire Jeff Sessions over Peter Suderman's objections. So my question in light of these comments, aren't these comments not a somehow a category difference from what we've seen before from presidents when it comes to sort of explicit politicization of the law?
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think I was arguing otherwise in the past. It's just that, you know, the fact that Trump is openly attacking his, you know, his attorney general for continuing independent investigations that started ahead of time, you know, is pretty stunning. And I dislike the idea when people are, you know, talking about, oh, we got to worry about normalizing Trump and stuff like that. I am of the mind, you know, just like Trump is doing what he is, of course, has always been doing and will always be doing. And, you know, then the question for me really comes like, what happens when the reset happens? And it will either after the midterms or after Trump runs and wins re-election or fails to, or chooses not to run or whatever. But it's pretty staggering. I think we should. You know, we should be, you know, conscious of we have a president who is kind of a nut job when it comes to this sort of stuff. It doesn't negate like the positive, you know, things that are happening under him. I mean, you know, last week or thereabouts, you know, Betsy DeVos put in some new due process regulations at the Department of Education for people accused of assault on college campuses. That's good. There's a bunch, you know, the economy is doing pretty well, but he's a nut job.
Aren't you exhausted from the double to be sures every time we talk about
Absolutely,
Trump?
Yeah.
I mean,
it should
to
be four
sure,
be
it
sure.
Is
four be sure, just two by two. By, yeah, no, it is.
It's a four by four
and
be
that
sure.
That is, you know, part of how he wins in a way that Bill Clinton was like this, too. Bill Clinton famously said, you know, in a reference that even late boomers, certainly Gen Xers didn't get, but he said, like, I'm like Baby Huey. I just keep coming. Like, I keep coming, getting up after getting knocked down. It was a cartoon character from the early days, I guess, of TV. I don't even know. But Trump is like that, where he just doesn't stop. And after a while, you either give up or you stop paying attention or you dedicate every minute of every goddamn day to trying to defeat him somehow. And that way madness lies, for sure. I don't know about the other outcomes.
I prefer to think of Bill Clinton, even though he looks like Baby Huey, I prefer to think of him as droopy. He just every time you the wolf opens the closet door, it's this little guy going, hello, standing next to Louis Farrakhan. Peter, building on some of what Nick just said, We have seen at what are at this point the usual condemnations of Trump's comments from Ben Sasse, Jeff Flake, Justin Amash, maybe one or two other people. But another thing that we've seen in conjunction, or at least like 30 seconds later, is widespread outrage at those comments, not by Trump supporters, but by Trump haters, who are all like, enough of the talk, senators, I'm sick of it. So is the political center, kind of not ideologically, but temperamental center of American politics, the most hated place to be right now?
Who was it who was calling for like I believe it was Anne Applebaum in the Washington Post was calling for like basically a centrist revolution or something like a you know, some sort of private military, or I'm sure it would be public-private in the centrist worldview force. Or so. No, there's not actually a military force being called for. I'm kidding, obviously. The sort of signal trajectory change in American politics under Trump, but starting before him, has been a partisan polarization in which basically what you've seen is that both political sides have increased in intensity, not of liking their own people, but of hating the other side. And that is what we see every time Trump does something that's awful and Ben Sasse and Jeff Flake come out and say, hey, that's awful. And then somebody says, well, what are you going to do about that? And in fact, I think there's, you know, there's at least a partial point there, which is that Republicans have generally ceased to do their duty, their congressional duty to check the executive branch, Republicans in Congress here in Washington. But it's never enough. And it's never enough to say, hey, this is really actually super sketchy what Trump is doing. I mean, Flake's statement here is not sort of a mild, I don't know. It's not wishy-washy. He said, this is not the conduct of a president committed to defending and upholding the Constitution, but rather a president looking to use the Department of Justice to settle political scores. And I think that's totally right. What, though, is Jeff Flake, who, yes, is a senator, but is an outgoing senator, has basically is, you know, a lame duck at this point, is a lame duck in part because he reads, I suspect because he reads the political situation in his state and says, look, people don't support me. I do not have the political support to do anything, to do what I would like to do. So what then is Jeff Flake supposed to do? He's calling attention to this. That's more than other Republicans are doing. I think we should probably at least give him a half a golf clap for that.
Catherine, last week you said that Ben Sasse is the leading candidate to be the media's favorite Republican in the wake of John McCain's passing. But with Jeff Flake, who is your boyfriend in the Senate, leaving, is Ben Sasse your leading candidate to be Catherine's new senatorial boyfriend?
Wow. First, I just want to say
Jesus
that
Christ,
half
man.
Of a half of a golf clap, I think, is the middle finger. Like that, it's just one finger. Like that's all that's left. So. So I support that. Yeah, Ben Sasse is the leading candidate to me.
That's
my
your push
boyfriend.
For every politician, though?
The middle finger.
Yeah?
Yeah, exactly. Also, I think Shoshana Weissman will join me in that the Sasse fandom, which is right now small but growing. But as always, and I will say this every time, politicians will break your heart. They're going to do something terrible. Justin Amash has held off for so long doing something terrible that I can only assume at this point the terrible is going to be really terrible. So I live in fear of that. Sasse is still at the beginning of the arc. He's enjoying being, you know, the guy in the basketball shorts making trouble out, you know, while the grownups are trying to do business, which I like a lot.
Basketball shorts.
Yeah, he was sitting.
If you
outside,
haven't seen these,
it's hilarious. He's just like sitting on the railing outside of one of the office buildings in like his garbage gym clothes, and there's like real like senatorial business happening all around him. It's
and, like
the best.
Chuck Schumer's around him, but like more to Whoa. The point
more
or
to the
Peter's
point, though.
Point.
Yeah,
Catherine,
yeah. Sorry, we got derailed.
No, but the point is not the boyfriend stuff. But is what. What can what should a senator be doing? I mean, it
That's
seems
it.
To me
That's
that
all they can that... do is make the angry statements. I mean, at this point, you know, there's no There's no tidy way out, and there's not going to be for a while.
So
they could advance a legislative agenda.
Right.
I mean, this is part of the thing.
Totally separate from should they advance a legislative agenda, which no, duh, obviously, yes, they should. Like, senatorial and congressional Republicans should be doing the good things well, like, obviously. But for a while, we are all just going to be tied up in knots about the coming sessions apocalypse, whatever form that takes, and
I don't worry about him being fired because these investigations will not disappear. Like, you know, the good investigations won't disappear if Sessions is fired. I think it would be, you know, it would be both interesting as a journalist to see, you know, how that all plays out and whatnot. But I mean, this is where, you know, people, by giving Trump all of the time of day, it's like, you know, Congress should be advancing an agenda. They fail. Peter, you're right that they failed to check, you know, they're failing to check executive power on a certain level. You know, remember Trump, like with DACA and whatnot, you know, he said, like, look, go ahead and pass something. And they never did. I mean, they can't pass budgets. They won't pass budgets. It's like they're free riding off of the, you know, people being focused on Trump as well. And this is something that was started really under George W. Bush. And the minute after 9/11, when we started doing everything through emergency appropriations, including funding the Iraq War, you know, regular order and the expectation that Congress would actually fucking do their job went out the window and has never come back. And I think that's the essential problem, not that Trump is a blowhard spaz.
It's true. I mean, but we, like, the people on this podcast definitely agree with you about that by and large. And I think our listeners also probably, you know, have heard.
Have you taken a survey?
Have heard
do we
this
have a
song
listener poll?
From us before. At least we should have a listener poll. I'd like to do that. But I think that question is still separate from the question of how our, you know, quote unquote, our guys, how are the guys, the few people on the Hill supposed to react? And I do think, you know, this is something where we just have to say, like, Jeff Sessions is a bad attorney general. Also, it would be bad if he was fired in an attempt to undermine an investigation into a bad president, which is what my friend and also fancy pants legal scholar Josh Chaffetz tweeted this morning. He's right. That's right. That's the right position here. And it's hard for senators to say that out loud or on Twitter without sounding mushy and equivocating.
So I think one of the problems with the liberal criticism of Republicans who criticize Trump, especially Republican senators, is that they seem to expect then that Republican senators who oppose Trump even quite consistently and
will support a Democratic policy agenda.
Right, will support a Democratic policy agenda, or will, for example, do things like vote to block or hold, at least hold off the Kavanaugh nomination. And that seems to me like, okay, if you're a Republican who doesn't like Trump, especially if you're, say, Jeff Flake, probably it's because Donald Trump is not a very good advocate for limited government and free market ideas. And so that doesn't mean that you're then going to step in the way of, say, Kavanaugh getting nominated, of something that looks more like a traditional small government conservative agenda. Not that Republicans have always been great on that front, even pre-Trump. In fact,
they've often
been pretty bad, I will say. On the other hand, Jeff Flake is better than the average Republican, and his opposition to Trump is that Trump is much worse than the average Republican on those issues.
But don't you also think this is my hobby horse, which I'm going to climb up on now, which is that the root of that confusion, the root of the confusion when people on the left or Democrats see the Republicans who oppose Trump and they are confused and angry about why those people don't basically just become Democrats, it's because of this idea that I think is particularly endemic to the American centrist left, that if everyone just had the right information and were of good heart and goodwill and thought about it for a minute, they would be centrist Democrats. Like, that was the Obama thing. Like, I am happy to extend the hand of greeting as long as you think carefully and come to the same conclusions as me. And this is the expectation for people like Sasse and Flake and Amash, which they can never fulfill because that's an unreasonable expectation.
The center left does have a lot of really, like a lot of studies that show things, and we should be paying attention to them.
Ooh, studies.
But isn't
point.
I mean, from a libertarian point of view, because the Republican Party, and I mean, like, one of the things, if we can stop doing one thing, it's to stop pretending that the rhetoric of the Republican Party, at least since Reagan, you know, had some connection to how they actually govern, because they're, you know, it's just simply not true. And the Bush years demonstrated that with absolute, you know, with like atomic certainty. I mean, they flattened the idea that the Republican Party was the party of small government. It simply isn't. Having said that, last year, or not last year, whatever, the tax bill passed, there was something, you know, that actually got done. And we should be holding, you know, especially from a libertarian perspective, we're not Republicans and we're certainly not Democrats. And, you know, it is actually enough to say, you know, that, you know, let Trump do what he wants. He's not going to stop these investigations. And in fact, if he starts acting the way he is, he's only going to intensify them and kind of reify them. But more to the point, like we really need to kick Congress's ass, rhetorically, if not figured, or rhetorically, if not in reality.
I mean, to be clear, Nick, I totally agree that Republicans are very bad on these issues. And one of the reasons.
Why do we continue to pretend? You know, anything like that.
Because a couple of them aren't bad. Like, that's why.
Yeah, but they're not Republicans. I mean, somebody like, you know, Jeff Flake has been chased out of his party because he was afraid of being primaried. Justin Amash has been hated, you know, so deeply by two consecutive speakers of the House that, like, they don't even acknowledge his presence when he's in the same room as them. You know, so, I mean, right there, you know.
Just to add a data point to what Catherine was talking about in some of the reaction I've seen to the McCain funeral week that we had last week, variations on, I believe Adam Davidson, the New Yorker, is the one who I'm quoting here now, saying like, yes, you know, all that the bipartisan kind of anti-Trump stuff is all great. But let's be honest, he's only did one thing over the last 2 years to oppose Trump, and that was vote against the Obamacare, the skinny Obamacare repeal and replace. And that type of thinking, I think, is infuriating is too strong of a word, but it's just lazy. You know, writing a book, which is something Jeff Flake and John McCain did, both that are kind of explicitly against the Trump version of Republicanism, which is now dominant. That's not a nothing act. That's an act. It doesn't have any legislation. It doesn't. There's all kinds of stuff that they should do in addition to that. But it's not nothing. And especially in the Senate, which is by design the place where gas bags go to uncork wind. That's part of their job description.
Nope.
What?
Just
what do you mean?
That was not a metaphor.
Yeah, that is a metaphor. Yeah, very good.
I want to shift, although it's a sort of a natural continuation in its own way with the politicization of everything. This is sort of a three-headed news clump that all the people are talking about at the moment. So,
wait,
yes,
do clumps have heads?
Yep. Yep. Yep.
It's not a not like a three-headed dragon.
What is this, the Eddie Murphy movie, The Clumps? Wasn't there an Eddie Murphy movie called The Clumps?
I think with two P's or two M's.
And a K. In which Eddie Murphy played, I believe, all the clumps.
Yeah.
Save us.
Yeah, that guy is
The news now seems better than this conversation, which is a real achievement.
Just go see Bowfinger, people. Yesterday, the New Yorker magazine, under the usual requisite pressure from social media, rescinded its invitation to have editor David Remnick interview troglodyte Steve Bannon at its Ideas Festival. That's number one. Number two, Nike unveiled a new 30th anniversary ad for the Just Do It slogan, which features Colin Kaepernick's giant face and the words, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything." Which has then led to the requisite acts of people showily cutting off the swoosh on their Nike garments and posting it to Instagram. And number three, because it's a rule of three, the chair of California's dominant Democratic Party called for a boycott of In-N-Out Burger.
A boycott?
Because the fast food chain was discovered to have donated $25,000 to the hated Republican Party. Rule of three. Nick, I saw you tweeting about the New Yorker Festival thing first. So,
if I can, I'll just I want to preempt you by saying that a friend of mine who's in his late 50s, might even be early 60s, but he kept referring to In-N-Out Burger as Stop and Go Burger, which seems so right. Like I didn't have the heart to correct it.
I wish she would refer to it as a pup and taco, which is the only real fast food chain.
That's true. I don't know what he would come up with that, but it reminded me of the time my father once in the 70s referred to Cheech and Chong as Gooch and Gongo, which I still think of them as, is that one Gooch or is that Gongo?
It is so, it's so racist, and yet I don't know against who.
Robbie Suave Reason put a post up about that, you know, the New Yorker shouldn't have disinvited or deplatformed Steve Bannon. He was going to be interviewed by David Remnick. It was not going to be a friendly interview, and I think it would have been an interesting interview. There's also an Errol Morris documentary that I'm dying to see, which is a long interview with Steve Bannon. And, you know, Errol Morris, his last big movie was about Donald Rumsfeld. And like, should he not have talked to Donald Rumsfeld because Donald Rumsfeld is pretty much pure evil? It's an idiotic response that has become shockingly common on both the right and the left, but I think especially not on the left, the liberals, to say that to even talk to somebody is to somehow endorse their entire program or normalize them and give them, you know, a platform. I think there are people who are not worth talking to. People like Milo Yiannopoulos, for instance, is, you know, like the worst thing that ever happened to him is when he was finally allowed to speak and everybody realized he had nothing to say. Steve Bannon is more consequential than that. And what he, talking to him and getting a better understanding of how he thinks and also what his possible appeal was to people, I find as somebody who, not from a liberal point of view, from a libertarian point of view, hated Breitbartism, as it was played out on the site, and hated, Bannon's, bizarre basket of deplorable policy situation, you know, positions, none of which were particularly libertarian. It's a sad thing. And I think that that kind of political correctness and mobocracy is actually starting to break, because you are seeing people, whether it's the intellectual dark web, which is much more ideologically diverse than most people want to, agree or acknowledge. But, you know, when you have people like Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt coming out with The Coddling of the American Mind, which went on sale yesterday, when you have people like Steven Pinker, you know, these are pretty centrist liberals who are like, enough already. Like, we need to have open discussions in an open society if we want to maintain our kind of quality of life and a vibrant intellectual environment. And I think this is a step away from that, and it's a mistake because of it.
Catherine, is the fever really breaking, or is the clump growing? Or more to the point, isn't this kind of the future that everyone except libertarians seems to want? Like, just let's politicize everything, make impotent boycott threats that don't really lead to anywhere, very, very urgent and always unintentionally hilarious when it's done by the types of people who contribute to The New Yorker, kind of debates about, normalization and deplatforming. And then everyone pretends that they're being philosophically consistent on free speech issues, and they're not. It just feels like there's more of this. There's three of these a week. There's five of these a week. It's not slowing down.
Yeah. I mean, the person who is deplatformed in any one of these circumstances, a huge percentage of the time, would cheerfully be on the other side of the howling mob if the circumstances were slightly different, right? Like, of course, Bannon and his crowd would, like, howlingly deplatform David Remnick if they happen to be able to, right? This is not, you know, this is a sort of a tricky situation for people who are genuine, consistent advocates of free speech and also of the culture of free speech, such as it is sort of below the level of the law, because, you know, someone is an asshole and then they get kicked out of a fancy pants conference or whatever for being an asshole, and they turn to us and they're like, hey, you should defend me. You're for me, right? I should be allowed to speak. And it's this sort of, you know, and then everyone changes chairs and they get to be the asshole. But I do think the problem is that we wind up with, if everyone deplatforms everyone else, we're just all like standing on a little scrap of wood as like the shipwreck floats around us. Like, eventually we will have to.
And eventually we become Jack in Titanic and just sort
basically,
of.
Basically, yeah, it's just like a door or whatever, right? Like, that's what they were on. I don't know. I never saw that movie. But
Now you're just virtue signaling.
I am. That's my strong. I did that on purpose, and I will stand by it. Not seeing Titanic is the greatest thing I've ever done. Right. So, but if we break up the platforms until each person is just their own platform and they've deplatformed everyone who is not like them or disagrees with them forever and ever, amen, it's going to be awfully lonely. I think, you know, Remnick was not gutless to confront, to cancel, which is what Bannon alleged. But this is also what happens when you blend journalism and selling tickets for showmanship, right? Like, no one would have objected to Remnick interviewing Bannon in the pages of the magazine. But once it starts to be kind of a show in which Bannon is part of the show, it does get a little blurrier.
Nick mentioned John Haidt, and just hearing you talk about that, Catherine, makes me think. I mean, Haidt has his, I forget the term of art, but the way, the moral values that different people have about different things. And I think there's a sense of sacredness that that kind of liberals have towards the New Yorker, the New York Times, you know, op-ed page. There are certain places that are supposed to be pristine, and they cannot be sullied by these bad monster
people. It's all purity stuff, right? I mean, that's what it is. It's like everyone has a sense of where their purity lines are going to be violated, and they're highly specific and changeable. And of course, it's exactly the same thing to be burning your dumb sneakers because your feet are now impure because they're inside the shoes vaguely associated with someone who has views different than your own about the relationship between African-Americans and the police. Like, geez, Louise, just wear your sneaks and skip the Ideas Festival or whatever you want to do.
But Peter, here's a thought. Maybe there's only like two dudes who cut out the swoosh. Maybe everyone is kind of performatively overreacting to what a couple of a-holes on Twitter do or say, and then gin up this kind of largely symbolic and not really a real exercise in a mutual outrage that people in Nick Gillespie's real America don't even give one rip about.
I think that if social media didn't exist, the vast majority of these controversies, these deplatforming controversies would not exist either. And I think you're totally right to suggest that these things get blown up from very, very small acts of kind of piddly protest online into much larger acts. And what social media does is that it accelerates and intensifies this stuff. And what was our first topic today? It was Donald Trump's tweets. That's our first topic almost every single week. Twitter, Facebook, all of these things really, like I said, they sort of intensify and increase the feeling that you are being that speech is assaulting you. And so there is a, what they end up doing is they make it feel like there's no exit from speech. And I think that that's wrong. And I think that we should resist that feeling. But when, but the whole idea of the newsfeed, of the way that Twitter functions with sort of the constant scroll of stuff from whoever you have selected to follow, is that it feels like there is all of this speech coming unbidden, uninvited into your world all of the time. And so as that has happened, I think people have responded by saying, no, we need to keep the other side out. We need to keep the bad guys out. We need to make sure that the New Yorker never talks to Steve Bannon. That is my safe place. I think that this is, like I said, a bad way to think about social media and a bad response. But I do think that social media creates this response in a lot of people, and that it's not an accident that this type of debate and this type of controversy happens a lot more in a world of social media than it did 20 years ago when we were all quasi-offline most of the time.
And our third thing in the trend of three is the In-N-Out boycott, right? Which the guy who started it, right? The guy who started it, Eric Bauman, who is the chairman of the California Democratic Party, he told the Sacramento Bee this weekend, there is no boycott. I put out one tweet at 10:30 at night and it turned into a whole thing. Like, shruggy. We've raised so much money in small donations as a result of that tweet, and people have engaged almost a million people. It's amazing how big, how this became a big boycott. So there's, like, it's not a boycott. It is a boycott. It's actually just a tweet. And, like, I think we can all agree that 10:30 at night is code for I was drunk. So it's like one drunk tweet.
Yeah, there's
a hashtag.
Like a, there's got to be a rule like after 10 o'clock, your tweets don't count.
Or like after 10 o'clock, we just assume like it's drunk.
They really
tweeting.
Count.
It's a separate. Yeah, no, it's a separate account. And I think that's
10.
So mean, it just supports
Peter's 5:15.
Peter's thesis that like things happen on Twitter and the ways in which things that happen on Twitter become things in the world are both disproportionate and somewhat unpredictable.
And so this is amplified by the fact that if you know journalists, if you come to the Reason newsroom, every journalist, every person in media spends 18 hours a day on Twitter, and that's like 3 hours of their sleep, their dreaming tweets, and then the rest of the time they have at least one eye on a Twitter screen at all moments. And so what happens is the media feels like Twitter is the real world. And so because the media feels like Twitter is the real world, they report on it as if it is the real world because it is their real world. And then increasingly, it becomes the real world. And a lot of people sort of end up accepting that reality.
Can I ask, I think you're right. I mean, there's no question that social media is what enables this kind of activity and this kind of obsession. But you guys just a couple weeks ago were saying, and it's good, like, you know, it's good for individual platforms to deplatform people, to kick, you know, Alex Jones off of YouTube, off of Twitter, off of Facebook, whatever. I was arguing that, no, we really need like a more holistic kind of liberal, you know, classical liberal understanding of like, no, we should have more of a scrum of free speech. So, you know, what is it then? Because like, obviously, it's within the right of the New Yorker festival of bullshit to, you know, invite whoever they want and everything. But it would be a better society, wouldn't it be? Well, I guess I have two questions. Wouldn't it be better if we all just were like, you know what, we're, you know, to quote George Costanza, we're living in a society. And it's like, you know, people fucking disagree in a society, and let's have those conversations in the open. But then secondly, to Peter's point, do any of you feel assaulted by people you don't like on YouTube, on Facebook, or on Twitter? Like, I fucking swear to God, I have never seen an Alex Jones video, and obviously, I guess that has passed, but, you know, I never saw one unless I went hunting for one. And all of these tools, the whole point of them is that you can tailor your experience, so you never have to fucking see anything that you don't want. So, you know, I think there's something more at work here that is problematic,
it's,
and
it's
it feeds back to that larger question of like, nobody actually wants to hear people talk. Everybody just wants everybody to agree with them and shut the fuck up.
It's very clear, I think, just looking at how people interact and on social media and how they talk about social media and what they demand from social media, that people do feel assaulted, and people do. That is a common feeling. And so I'm not trying to say that I don't tailor my own experience or that I'm getting Alex Jones videos all the time. I quit Facebook because I found it useless and irritating. I took a couple of weeks off of Twitter, canceled my account or shut down my account because I just felt like I had had enough and it wasn't all that. It was distracting me from doing things that I wanted to do. But I've come back on and it is quite sort of useful and interesting. My point is not that I personally always feel like I'm being assaulted and have no control, but that people clearly do, and that that's where these demands are coming from, is that people feel as if this is a speech invasion that they are helpless or semi-helpless to get away from. And so because social media is their world, and because the owners and operators of social media platforms are effectively the kind of they're little governments that sort of govern these little worlds. They are demanding that the governors of social media platforms step in and take action. It's very similar to what we see in the real world with actual governments.
So I would shy away from the metaphor of governments there, but I do think the answer to your question, Nick, was at the end of your question. Like, people are taking a minute. It's a tumultuous time. There are gales of creative destruction sweeping through our platforms. And we've got a minute here where we're going to have to redefine all our terms of service of everything. And I think when it shakes out, there's going to be clearer ways to opt into spaces where you're going to see stuff that's offensive and annoying, and opt into spaces where you see stuff that's warm and fuzzy and validating, and opt into spaces where you get a big fire hose of both, which is what Twitter essentially is right now for most people. And I think it's fair to talk about what those spaces should look like in the end, and to not ask in a kind of static way for the spaces that exist right now to do the thing you described just then. Like, something will exist where that's a place where you can go get your Alex Jones if you want to get a little Alex Jones, or you can be pushed Alex Jones if you want to be pushed Alex Jones occasionally, or you can never see Alex Jones. And it's just that we built all these platforms to do one thing. We want something different now, and we have to build new ones. And it's cool to just be like, blow them all up, start over.
To answer Nick's question about what should happen, though, I just like will very briefly say, I think what should happen is not that we should go running to the authorities to make this problem go away. I think what should happen is that people should realize they do have the power to take to make their own decisions about what they see and what they don't. And that includes exiting these platforms entirely. I've done it, like I said, for certain periods of time, and I've tailored my experiences to the way that I want them to be so that they are more useful to me. And so the message should be here that you have the power. Don't listen to these people. Don't look at this stuff. If you want to block them, block away. It's built into the platform. It's part of the system. You have that power. Don't force everyone else to accept the, you know, to abide by the tailoring and that you want for yourself.
See, that to me, if I can just throw out there, at the same time, the more moderated places, and I'm thinking of places like the New York Times op-ed page, maybe the LA Times op-ed page, places like the Daily Beast, the New York NPR and whatnot, are actually, weirdly enough, are moving towards inclusion of more diverse viewpoints, it seems to me. And certainly, you know, a libertarian viewpoint. And I don't think it's simply because we're a kind of right-wing alternative to Bannonites or anything like that. And I think it's a better world because of it. And it's, I really just can't wait to get to the next moment, because it is like, it is insufferable, Peter. Like, people don't want, they don't want to have to exit if they don't like the conversation. They really want to control the conversation in every space. And it's tedious. And I think it's a root problem that is deeper than social media, although social media allows it, the worst version of it, to kind of rise to the surface.
To triangulate here in agreement with everybody, but yet somehow floating above, is that I agree with Nick that there is a culture and an ethic out there that right now in this country, I believe, is sick. It's us, by which I mean mostly Peter, it's the consumers. It's the people who are every day, if you look on your Twitter feed, again, within the first 20 or 30, there's going to be someone saying that that person shouldn't be allowed to do X usually in a speech related way. That is a sickness. For me, it's not about criticizing the choices of Facebook and YouTube, although obviously that's going to be ham-handedly and with a political bias associated with it. But it's the choices of all of us going immediately to these idiotic deplatforming kind of arguments and ethics, and constantly drawing these fuzzy lines around who's in and who's out. It's garbage. We have to stop that and go more for the Errol Morris ethic of, hey, let's interact. Let's try to actually understand the people who have power there. I recall,
let's put America on the Interatron.
I thank God don't know what that means.
The Interatron, it's Errol Morris's special camera that he uses so that he can look into the camera, and the person who he's interviewing can also look directly at the camera, but they can see each other's faces.
I remember in one of the previous conversations that we've had, these national conversations we've had over this, someone went searching for, like a regular pro-Trump columnist at a major newspaper, or regular kind of, MAGA types on the cable news networks and whatever. And there are a couple, but they're basically almost none. And 60 million people voted for the guy. And they didn't all share Steve Bannon's values, thank God, because they're terrible. But they are out there. It's not necessarily a plea to have affirmative action for people whose beliefs that I find odious or whatnot. But we should all be looking around and noting where there is and is not ideological diversity, and what the forces are of people who are talking about these things. And I think it's a constant policing. It's a constant velvet rope monitoring of who gets to come in and go out. And that's a sickness. And I think we should be arguing for constant expansion and take off your helmet and get out on the playground type of approach. And that's the memo. Let's shift to a... Yeah, you guys noticed that Kennedy's been doing this now. She's like ever since Papa Bear O'Reilly left Fox News.
She's doing the memo now.
She does a little sermonette near the top of her show and says, "And that's the memo," which is pretty great. So over last week at some point, the Secretary of State of the state of New Mexico, quick, name the motto of New Mexico. Nick, you can't go. Peter or Catherine, what's the motto of New Mexico? It is the what state?
The screw you state?
The very hot state.
Go ahead, Nick.
It's the land of enchantment.
Boom!
Wow.
This is why we have Nick Gillespie, people.
It really is. That's a terrible motto.
It's wonderful motto.
Magical.
It's not.
Better. Arkansas is land of opportunity, so it's better than that. New Jersey is the garden state, you know?
Yeah,
the whole idea of a state motto that it should be just like the most blatant lie you could possibly tell about your state.
It's like if a headline is a question, the answer is no. Like your state motto is the, What is, I don't even, I guess Virginia is for lovers. I don't know.
Well, they have, Virginia is for
the
lovers.
Theme of blatant
but
lies.
But it's also Old Dominion.
Also the mother of presidents.
But that's untrue. I mean, because Ohio actually has more presidents.
You
want to
fight me, Gillespie?
I don't want to, but I will.
Speaking of which, watch Catherine and Nick fight it out in the pages of Reason Magazine on issues that are on newsstands and in your mailbox right now. It's very
that's right. The
fun.
Debate issue is out. Everyone should read it. Me and Nick on anarchism versus minarchism.
So last week, the New Mexico Secretary of State announced rather suddenly that the state is going back to straight ticket voting, party line voting on its ballot. What that means is that you can, if you are a voter in the November elections, that is, if this thing survives court challenges, which I kind of think it won't, but we'll see. You can check a single box. Beep, and then every member, every candidate from that party, whether it's the Democratic Party, Republican Party, Libertarian Party, or Green Party, every member of that party down ballot gets your vote. You only need to click one box or fill in one oval in order to do this. She said in her statement of doing this that this was to give voters more options, which is kind of funny, but also that it, you know, speeds up voting and this type of thing. New Mexico had this for a long time. Gary Johnson, as governor, assigned it a rescission. Anyways, got rid of it, but it took 10 years after that for it to be gotten rid of. She is reinstating it. New Mexico is one of 9 states that does this right now. Seems to me and to a lot of people, including Gary Johnson, including the Libertarian and Republican parties of New Mexico who are suing and challenging this, pretty naked attempt to try to blunt a pretty serious Libertarian Party challenge to the U.S. Senate and the incumbent there, Martin Heinrich, in a state that is pretty overwhelmingly Democratic. The Secretary of State herself is up for re-election, is a member of the Democratic Party. So I guess first in talking about this, I want to check my own premises on that. And I'll start with Suderman here. This was recently upheld in the state of Michigan, one of, again, 9 states that did this. They voted to overthrow it. And the courts there said, no, you have to keep it because this option is disproportionately used by Black voters. And so therefore, it's up against the Voting Rights Act. Is there a positive case for this that you can see?
If I want to make a positive case for it, it would be that it simplifies and streamlines the act of voting for people who might not know of, who might find it intimidating to have to learn and research all of these candidates. Lots of people are not like us, do not enjoy reading about politics or figuring this stuff out. In fact, find it a burden, find it difficult, but want to participate in the process. Again, I'm making the case not because I think that this is the best one, but because I think that it's sort of plausible. So if you've ever played a role-playing game,
There's a party, a squad role-playing game that's also single player, so you control multiple players. There's often an option where you can just level up your non-main characters basically by saying, do it for me, right? I'm not going to pick the stats. I'm not going to pick all the perks on all of this. You can just, like, all of these extra guys who I sometimes use on some of these missions, just, computer, go ahead and do this leveling up for me. Now, the people who really enjoy playing the game never pick that option because it doesn't allow you to customize all of your team members. On the other hand, the people who are just sort of in it casually and want to play this game a little bit without going really deep into customizing five different party members, they're gonna say, look, it's fine. I just want to level this guy up and play this game and see what the story is. I think there are people who are like that in the world of politics, too. They want to vote. They want to participate. But they don't always want to spend the time to do all of the research that is necessary to pick pick a person for every spot on the ballot.
Can I borrow your nerdball metaphor and tweak it a little bit?
Yep.
I think that unfortunately what the straight ticket voting does is it's basically Democrats using black voters as the zombie extra squad members, right?
Like
I think it's sort of exploitive. It's taking advantage of what is sort of an anticipated voting behavior that people don't fully execute when left on their own for good reasons. Like, people don't click all the way down the ballot because they don't want to click all the way down the ballot, not because, like, somehow they're confused or they haven't done their research. Like, you don't have to do your research to go tick, 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 tick all the way down. I mean, I think that's what
voting is.
Why
read the whole article when you can just read the headline? This is a phenomenon we are aware of.
This is like Axios? It's like Axios for voting?
We shouldn't count them in the totals of people who read all the way to the bottom. That's not how we do our analytics at Reason Magazine. It's not how we should do elections. Mm.
No, to be clear, I am not actually...
I don't believe the case for straight party voting options.
I, in fact, think that this is very clearly, very, very clearly an attempt by the two major parties to make it more difficult for Gary Johnson to get elected.
And
I can't
also
see any other actual plausible explanation for the particular timing of this being reinstated in this particular way.
Clearly in this particular case, that's what's going on. But I also think, like, a side effect is that it inflates the perceived legitimacy of down ballot elections by inflating those totals, when in fact people are not engaged in them at all. The vote totals, when straight ticket voting is available, do not reflect what people think and feel about those candidates.
Catherine, I'd really appreciate that you just want to, like, maintain the legitimacy and, like,
of down ballot voting. I do.
As a principled, longtime non-voter.
Yeah, because
somebody
I want to be represented down there. Other people shouldn't vote. Yep.
The non-voting
down there should be correctly captured.
You couldn't see Titanic because you were too busy not voting. If
that's right.
I remember the full story.
I also don't have cable TV, just to hit the triumvirate of douchebag signaling.
Yeah. I hope you don't have a radio, or you just have like a crystal radio set or something, and that only gets NPR.
I say, Pa, put on the wireless.
Catherine has one of these, like an NSA spy tool thing that you sort of like suction cup to your window, and it. I mean, it's like there's like some long string of cable business.
I just did that.
And I think it's basically just to watch Downton Abbey.
Is that right? No, it was just to watch Sherlock.
Okay. Sorry, I forgot.
I only watched the lower class characters in Downton Abbey, so I've perfected this even more.
Wow, your class consciousness is truly a model for us all.
A lot of those people are straight ticket voters, and they need an extra option.
The argument in favor of straight ticket voting, though, is that party affiliation does have meaningful information that attaches to it. Because there are in states like Ohio, it's really hard, from what I understand, it's really hard to get a line like a party affiliation on your ballot unless you're a Republican or a Democrat. At various points, they try to strip out the Libertarian or the Green or whatever, because people who are not sure about stuff want that information and will vote accordingly. Matt, I agree with everybody that this is transparently a way to fuck over Gary Johnson because he's a legitimate threat to Heinrich. And that should be called out for what it is. That's all it is. And hopefully that'll motivate people in New Mexico to go vote for Gary Johnson, who would be fantastic. I think, in the Senate. Having said that, you know, what aren't the the states are laboratories of democracy, which is one of the shittiest terms ever used. And it came out of a court case where Nebraska, I think, wanted to ban the teaching of German during World War I because it was seen as unpatriotic. They should have the right to do whatever they want.
Can we give a little shout out here to Richard Winger, who has been running Ballot Access News, yeah, I think, since the dawning of time,
yeah,
and who tracks this stuff. Like, if you are interested in any of this stuff, go check out this dude's site. He has like a very handy little list of which states have straight ticket devices, as they are apparently known. And you can, like, I always find that there is interesting stuff when you go deeper on these sorts of questions. And as Matt mentioned, like the Michigan back and forth on this is pretty fascinating. There are a bunch of states that do currently have straight ticket options. Alabama, Indiana, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Utah. Like, there's a bunch of places where this is the reality and has been for a long time. That will certainly be the argument that people offer up as to why maybe New Mexico should have it too. But the timing is bullshit.
The trend line on this, I think something like five states have gotten rid of it in the last 5 to 10 years. It is seen as a shortcut for partisan membership. I mean, even since 2000, not even since 1970, which is oftentimes a time period that Nick and I in particular like to point towards, but since 2000, the number of people who do not register with one of the two political parties and we're not talking about your sense of personal affiliation. We're talking about your actual party registration figures there. It has gone, it just kind of skyrocketed. It's now right neck and neck with the number of people who register the Republican Party. And so what you're telling to people who either take an approach that includes, yeah, I'll look at a lot of different people, or I just don't belong to a political party, you're telling them that all those other people have an option that you can't take, and it's going to speed up their process.
So one way of thinking of looking at this, and this is really kind of, making a silk purse out of a total, sack of shit here to make a metaphor. No, but this is the behavior of a desperate political class. It's just like as apartheid laws were more and more strictly enforced, the closer it came, to the reality that apartheid was
exactly like apartheid.
Yeah,
though.
Let's.
Now, I'm using words here.
Point.
Okay, these are metaphors, but this is the behavior of a group that is getting flushed down the toilet, and they know it. And the major parties, the more that they act like this, in the near term, in the very near term, it may be like, so then Gary Johnson only gets 20% of the vote or something like that. But this, it actually accelerates the end. I mean, these people are just trying. This is, we've been talking about the Titanic. I mean, this is like the ship is about to go perpendicular to the ocean, and people are trying to, hang on to what is left, because it, and in that sense, more power to New Mexico, because with every stupid shitbag move like this, you are actually speeding up your own demise.
In defense of Nick's apartheid metaphor, I think there is a truism, it's not blanket, but of, the fist clenches hardest right before it breaks up. What? Did you squeak? You don't squeak at me.
Hardest right before it breaks up.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, what is very, the fist made of? Concrete? Like
the night is blackest before the dawn. The fist clenches hardest. The heart wants what the
fist wants.
The heart wants what it wants. Woody Allen wants what he needs.
I think we're gonna have to upload that one to Pornhub.
Let's.
I, if we want the most. Disturbing metaphor was actually Peter's one of essentially, or talking about down ballot candidates are like non-player characters. They don't actually exist. They don't, and like the idea that you're just voting for senator or governor, and then everybody else, like, who gets
you got to keep a wizard in your squad is what I'm saying.
Speaking of wizards, let's exit out with our end of show. Dungeons and Dragons version is Peter playing here. Peter, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'm reading The Secret Place, the fifth novel in Tana French's detective series, the Dublin Murder Squad series.
I'm about not quite halfway through. It's really great, as all of her books have been.
I think you're getting kickbacks from Tana French.
No, nope. Like, I mean, I'm just going to keep recommending them.
80% of your recommendations on this podcast have been Tana French books, and you're not wrong.
They're good. Only happened five times. It just so happened, however, that prior to me joining the podcast, I several times recommended Tana French to you, and then I turned out to be correct. You liked her books. So you have heard the recommendations more than our readers. The author is Tana French. She's an Irish mystery writer, and her series is the Dublin Murder Squad series. There are six books in it. This is the fifth one. They've all been great. That's why I keep reading and recommending them. This one is the first one to depart structurally from the first-person detective from the singular first-person detective view that we have seen in the other books. What's really interesting about her is she's a former actress, and so you really see... I kind of view these books, all of which, like I said, are told in first person up until this one, which splits between a first person and then a third person view. They're all kind of performances. And what she's doing is embodying and taking on the character of her detectives and showing us their world through language. They're really smartly plotted mysteries that also happen to take place often in the wake of the recession and sort of what has been happening with the Irish economy. If I wanted to make a slightly too clever but somewhat supportable argument, is that her true subject is Irish tax policy, because all of the books end up taking place, end up heavily revolving around, or sort of at least touching on the changes in the Irish economy and the way that that changed the Irish society and culture over the last 10 or 15 years.
I will go second here and to talk up something that I've mentioned already before, and this is an accurate portrayal of what I've been consuming out there. It's Reason Magazine's latest issue, which is doubly pleasant for me. I think I can speak for Nick when I say, when you were a former editor of the magazine, one of the favorite things to happen is when the magazine shows up, because like, oh, what's in this? And in this particular case, Catherine was talking about doing this issue since back when Hector was a pup, back in the days when I was editor in chief, she was managing editor, and I was always a bit skeptical. It's like, I don't know, dude, maybe not. And this is just a delight of a lot of libertarians debating one another about major issues that divide people. And it's very fetchingly laid out. I was enjoying Eugene Volokh and Manny Klausner talking about, you know, baking the damn cake for the gay wedding couple and that kind of stuff. And it's great. And it's not just a sign of, a healthy publication, but more importantly, a sign of a healthy, broader movement that is grown up and can argue amongst itself in a respectful and lively way. And just enjoy it very much. And I can't wait to finish the rest of it. Nick, what are you consuming?
Yeah, I agree. That issue is really another home run. I feel like Catherine is Roger Maris at his peak. The issues just keep getting knocked
out
of the park.
That could literally be the meanest thing you've ever said about me, and I wouldn't know. So that was perfect.
No, it's really...
I'm assuming that was nice, but you could have just
really
named, like, America's worst baseball player.
It is quite a compliment, and it's because I forgot the guy who won the most recent home run derby at the All-Star game. So I went back to good old Roger Maris. I am reading The Splintering of the American Mind, Identity, Politics, Inequality, and Community on Today's College Campuses. It's by a guy named William Eggington, who's he's the chair of the English department at Johns Hopkins. And it's a look from a very kind of traditional left-wing, semi-progressive liberal point of view about how fucked up the academy is. And it's one more sign, I think, of this thaw that is happening, where people who are actually serious about ideas and just about getting on with life, rather than being mired in really annoying, frustrating, completely farcical, symbolic battles on things like social media, are starting to get serious again about talking about, okay, well, what are real ideas, and how do we talk about them, and how do we talk about policy? So, and if, you know, as somebody who is about the guy's age and went through grad school at the same time, it's really fascinating to see somebody talking about the culture battles within academia, which have a way of both reflecting and spilling out over into popular culture in a lot of ways. It's The title is obviously a callback to The Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom, which came out in the late 80s. There was a great book by a liberal, a response called The Opening of the American Mind. The Coddling of the American Mind just came out. I'm kind of done with the American Mind, but The Splintering of the American Mind is a very interesting book.
I actually think maybe we should publish an omnibus review of all the books post Closing of the American Mind with titles that play on that title.
I don't think
and
paper
I think
is cheap yet enough. Yeah, I don't think
we
paper
could
is
call
cheap
it
enough.
What the Hell Happened to the American Mind?
That's a very National Review title.
Catherine, what have you been filling your un-American mind with?
I did the most American thing this weekend, and I want to tell you guys about it. I went camping, you guys. It was a nightmare. And the thing I want to tell you...
It's 1,000 degrees outside.
I want to tell you about the WeatherMaster 2 10-person screened tent, which we borrowed from a friend. It's the biggest tent. It is, like Reason, it is a big tent. And it has two rooms. It's a tent with rooms. And I put up this tent with rooms in a forest. And I just want everyone to know that you can buy a tent with rooms for less than $200 in America today. So first of all, congratulations, capitalism. Second of all, congratulations, capitalism, for like making buildings where we can live indoors with air conditioning and like cook stoves that work. Because, of course, we arrived, we set up our stuff, we went on a little hike, and then it started raining at 6 p.m. and poured rain until 2 a.m. on top of my enormous 10-person
tent.
Was the tent dry?
Did it stay dry?
The tent was not fully dry, but that was a user error rather than tent error, and I don't want to blame the tent for my own failings. So,
Hashtag never camp.
Never camp, you guys. Don't go camping.
Matt, do you remember the old...
The only thing that rescued the whole experience was another awesome and super cheap little device, which was just the little propane stove, those little teeny propane stoves. I'd never seen one of those in real life before. Holy moly. It heats things up. You can cook your food. You can do it anywhere. It burns clean. Also glorious.
I have never been camping, and you have just convinced me that that has been the right decision. I've never really been in doubt, but
everything,
all evidence from people who have camped, even people who enjoy it.
Yes.
So I came back and I was like, you guys,
it was horrible. This is what happened. And everyone was like, that's what camping is like. I was like, why? Why would you do this?
I think we need a children's book called Catherine Discovers the Outdoors.
I could do that book for you in a minute. We just need Joanna Andresen to illustrate it. It would be a stuff of nightmares. Mud everywhere. Disgusting.
I think it would teach children valuable lessons about how you don't go outside in nature.
I can't figure out the shoes thing. Like, if you have your outdoor shoes on outdoors, you have to take them off to go in your tent, but then you have to put your shoes back on.
How do you charge your devices out there?
There were no devices. We were device-free.
What did you
Nick,
do?
Nick, save us with a 1970s
I was going to ask if, do you remember like old Sears Roebuck stories where in the sporting goods section they
wow.
would have one of those giant tents set up? And I can remember terrorizing, like, you would just hang out there while your parents were in the appliance section or the clothing sections and stuff like that.
My children unzipped one of the windows and pretended it was a television. I'm not even kidding.
Your children are going to be able to go virtual camping, and it will, like, relieve them of the desire to go regular camping because they'll just be able to put on
I'm going back to
goggles.
Last week's recommendation, Planet Earth 2 for my nature. That's how I'm getting nature.
That seems like the right way to experience it.
The next step and the only obvious one is virtual glamping to be done for all children.
Yeah.
That's all the glamping that we have time for. I want to recommend for those of you out there in the news consumption land who are interested in the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and the theater thereof to listen to some previous podcasts we've done right here on the Reason Podcast with Ken White, Jonathan Adler, Randy Barnett. I would predict without having to depend on it that we might hear from a Damon Root in the near future on such. So go and subscribe already to this and other Reason podcasts on iTunes and write a friendly review about Catherine's horror at the outdoors. And that's it. Have a good week.